What you are about to hear is the story of a connection that was made between a television series and a viewer's life. Our television set sits in the corner of our living room, befriending us, educating us, inspiring us, making us laugh or cry or tear our hair out in frustration. It is a far more constant companion than most of the friends we will ever make, or even our family. The You and Who books are the story of that companionship, that connection, as told by the people who watch the programmes that make us come alive, chiefly, of course, Doctor Who. This podcast will relate some of those stories. You're listening to You and Who Talking, and I'm J.R. Southall, the creator and chief editor of the series.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm JR, and we've got a bit of a first for You and Who Talking this week, in several ways. This is the first essay that is from a book that hasn't yet come out.
Ooh.
So listeners are getting a bit of an exclusive here. And this is also the first essay that's long enough to fill an entire episode by itself, rather than splitting the episode into two essays.
Hence, here we are at the start of the episode.
Yeah, instead of in the middle. So, this is from Steve Hatcher, who is from the Midlands, and who a name who a lot of people will recognise, because he's responsible for, the Hoovers group up in the Midlands, who once a year do, all through the year, they do various events of one kind or another, but they do a pretty well-known convention there once a year. In fact, I think Radio Free Scaro went there a couple of years ago when they were in the UK, and they've spoken about it a fair bit.
Oh, how interesting. Yeah, I listened to this with great keenness because I have a background with fan groups. I got into them when I was 13, 14, 15 years old kind of thing. But then the show went and ended, so it sort of petered off for me. And also, I was becoming an obnoxious teenager, so I didn't want to be in fan groups anymore.
Yeah.
When the show came back, though, in 2005, and I know other people out there might feel this, the internet and podcasts and websites had kind of taken over fan groups to some degree. They'd created sort of virtual fan groups.
Yes, yes.
So that fan groups like this, like that Stephen's part of, are a lot rarer now than they used to be in, say, the 80s, for example.
And I think the ones that do survive, and especially when you do it the way Steve does it, where you keep it going by making a thing of it, by having these events, so that it becomes more than just a bunch of people going to the pub or whatever. I think that's the way to do it. And the ones that do survive become more notable for that. So they become more precious and more special.
Yeah, I think so. So this is a really, really interesting essay, longer than the ones you've heard in past episodes, and well worth your time.
And I should mention before we go into it, there are two or three glitches in the second half where the file's corrupted slightly and there's just slight jumps, but there's only two or three and I don't think it'll affect anybody's enjoyment of listening to the essay.
Shall we have a listen?
I think we should.
My Life as a Hoover by Stephen Hatcher. Don't give them your phone number and don't tell them where you live. I'd smiled at my wife's final words to me as I left the house, but I don't think they were entirely meant as a joke. It was June 2000 and I was fast approaching my 42nd birthday and I was about to meet the Hoovers. Although I'd loved Doctor Who since I was a child, the first story that I remember seeing was The Web Planet. I was a bit of a late developer in terms of my fandom, having, through family circumstances, missed almost all of the Hartnell and Troughton years. I was 14 before the Christmas omnibus repeat of The Sea Devils got me hooked. I stayed with the show throughout the 1970s, apart from an 18-month period in 1979-80, when overseas study placements in Italy and France temporarily curtailed my travels in time and space. From season 18 onwards, I became a regular Who viewer, witnessing the end of Tom Baker, mostly enjoying Peter Davison and Colin Baker, and loving the fabulous creative resurgence of the Sylvester McCoy years. Remembrance, Fendrick, and Battlefield, yes, Battlefield, are still among my favourite stories. Oddly enough, it was not until the show had left the air that I became a fully-blown Doctor Who fan. During the early 1990s, we were living in Essex. A colleague at the school where I taught in Brentwood had started a Star Trek club, taking over a classroom one lunchtime a week to show the latest Next Generation episodes on VHS. I got involved and in so doing ignited that fan gene. The discovery that Chelmsford Library had a comprehensive and growing collection of Doctor Who videotapes brought me back to where my love of science fiction had started. In random order, I devoured them all, borrowing each one in turn, watching it immediately, and, of course, illegally copying it. The colour photocopier in the library even allowed me to copy the covers. At the same time, I began buying the tapes, starting with the ones that were not in the library, but quickly replacing my knock-off copies with legally bought kosher ones. I'd embarked upon a lifelong obsession. Chancing upon DWM, I found myself hooked on the magazine, too. As well as the articles and reviews that have always featured, it was quite common in those days to find convention reports, especially of the Dwas Panopticon events. I was intrigued. To tell the truth, these gatherings did look fun. The only problem would be the fact that Doctor Who fans were a bit weird, weren't they? Not for me, perhaps. This prejudice was rather reinforced when in the summer of 1995 we moved back to the Midlands, renting a house in a small village in Staffordshire while we looked around for a home to buy. We'd heard our neighbour before we met him, the loud, violent-sounding arguments that leaked through the walls and the barrage of foul language with which he assailed his partner in the street outside his house did not leave us with the best impression of him. When one day he came knocking on the door, we were wary. But seeing my Who VHS collection in the hallway, he immediately outed himself as a fellow fan, even inviting me round to see his signed photograph of Nicola Bryant. He moved away not long afterwards, and I've never, to my knowledge, seen him since. He was the first Who fan that I met, and the experience was a somewhat mixed one, which left my wife Tracy even more determined that Doctor Who fans were strange and undesirable characters. Time passed. McGann came and went, and the wilderness years seemed to be forever. My collection grew, and we moved to the house near Ashbourne where we still live. It was the last years of VHS, and the balcony of the market hall in Derby boasted a number of stalls with an impressive range of second-hand videotapes, including Doctor Who and other cult and science fiction television. I became a regular customer, and in particular became acquainted with the owner of one particular stall, from whom I'd bought a number of Doctor Who books and videos. He clearly had an interest in the show, but was not a fan. It was him who, on a whim, I asked one day if he knew of the existence of any Doctor Who fan organisations in the area. Well, as it happens, he replied, I do. Reaching behind the counter, he produced a piece of paper with a name and phone number on it. They're a new group. Give this chap a ring. It took a day or two for me to decide to follow this lead up, but eventually I rang the number, and so it was that I came to speak for the first time to my first Hoover, Gary Finney, which led to that first monthly Hoovers meeting at Q Workshop in Derby. I'm not entirely sure what I was expecting when I went to that first meeting. Gary had sounded perfectly normal, educated, intelligent, and down to earth. By no means the loony, obsessed fanboy that Tracy had warned me of. But I suppose there was always that niggling doubt. Here I was once more entering into one of those demi-mondes which exist hidden in plain sight in parallel to the everyday world. In my younger days, I'd been immersed in left-wing political groups, and had later dabbled with organised naturism, so I was far from a stranger to these never-wares, of which the average man or woman knows nothing. I'm sure that anyone reading this book, or hearing this article, will be unsurprised that what I found was a group of people, admittedly mostly men, especially in those days, who were warm, welcoming, and interesting. People who had much in common with the communists and nudists of my earlier acquaintance, in that they had an interest which they delighted in sharing and which provided the platform for a broader friendship. Like the communists and nudists, these Doctor Who fans were aware that those outside their circles regarded them as being a bit weird. In fact, they were happy to admit to a certain oddness, but they didn't really care. They were just getting on with enjoying what they wanted to do. At that first Hoovers meeting, I remember talking to Gary and to his fellow group founder Steve Hardy, as well as to Ian Farrington, who was shortly to take over the running of the group, and who would later go off to work for Big Finish in London. That night I probably met many more of the people who would go on to become friends for life, but in honesty I can't remember. Over the next year I got to know Robbie, Adam, Andy, Lee, Daniel, Ben, Mitch, Ewan, Steve P, Ian P, Nigel, Allen and many others. Monthly meetings were structured, well organised, and above all, fun. A highlight in those days was Desert Island Docs, which we still do from time to time, when a group member was interviewed, usually by Gary, wearing shorts more often than not, about which Doctor Who stories they would take to the eponymous island. One month, I was delighted to be asked to be the castaway, choosing the Sea Devils as my number one selection. During that first year, I was in my element, going to the meetings purely as a consumer, enjoying the entertainment provided and the company of my fellow fans. In the autumn of 2000, I attended my first convention, Panopticon in Manchester, and loved that first exposure to the wider Who world. Inevitably, though, the group was changing. Steve and Gary had given up running things, as had their successors Ian and Mitch. Steve and Gary had taken over again temporarily, but by the summer of 2001, they wanted to stop. No one was volunteering to take over, and there was even discussion about whether the group might have to come to an end. Very, very reluctantly, I put my hand up and agreed to take on the job. And, over 15 years later, I'm still doing it, and those people are still my very best friends. People have come and gone over the years. Ian moved to London. We don't often see Mitch or Nigel W. these days. Dalek Nigel S. went abroad and came back, but we don't see him anymore. The extraordinary prodigy that is Jonathan went off to university in Chester, where he then stayed. Dora and her bright and enthusiastic children, Jamie and Beth, now grown up, have moved on to other things, but they're still all there somewhere, and they are still all Hoovers. Most of them we still are in regular contact with, thanks to the miracle of the internet. Four of our brightest stars burned brightly, and then were lost to us at a shockingly early age. Adam Richards, star of the internet message boards and discussion groups, was an extraordinary talent, one of the naughtiest, most provocative and funniest people who anyone could hope to meet, whether contributing to fanzines or fan videos, or just ripping to shreds the ill-judged comments of some ignorant fool on Reckart's Doctor Who. Is that what it was called? Adam could always be relied on to offend the moderately easily offended and to entertain those looking on. He was something of a genius, in truth, whose brilliance is still talked about some 12 years after his sudden death in 2004. Kevin Shipton also died in 2004, a sad year for the group, following an accident at work. Kevin was a talented singer and pianist with a highly individual mind, which was, as group member Daniel Nix once wrote, untainted by popular opinion. Kevin could never understand why stories such as the Caves of Androzani and the Pyramids of Mars were popular, preferring instead the Sensorites, which he pronounced Sensorities. Abiding memories are his highly obscene but also entirely innocent mime of Anthony Ainley's surname during a game of charades, and his congratulating Terence Dix on his favourite Target book, Doctor Who and the Cave Monsters. When Terence pointed out that actually Malcolm Hawke had written that one, Kevin wouldn't have it at all, and insisted that Terence had got it wrong. After the death of his partner, Adam, I became very close to Robbie Langton. Robbie was another unique individual, a polymath who was equally likely to be found performing at a high standard in quizzes, knitting woolly hats, playing train sets with real trains, or playing, teaching and composing on a range of musical instruments. Although he could be prone to the occasional outburst of irrational anger, often at the vagaries of BBC scheduling, probably an effect of his diabetes, and his chronically bad stomach made offering him a lift a risky proposition, everybody loved Robbie. He was kind, wise and thoughtful, and fabulous company. Robbie died suddenly at a meeting of the Leicester Doctor Who group in June 2009, aged 64. His funeral, as Adam's had been, was a joyous and indeed hilarious celebration of a life too brief but well led. Most recently, in February of 2017, we lost Lee Lambert, a quiet but thoughtful and generous friend who was a stalwart of the group. Lee was born with a congenital heart condition, which he bore with courage, stoicism and good humour until it caught up with him at the age of 41. Lee lived life to the full, and is probably the only one of us that could have pulled off the TARDIS coffin that bore him on his final journey to the sound of the Doctor Who theme. As people have moved on, the Hoovers continues, as I write, in 2017, now in its 18th year, with dozens of special guest meetings and 8 Hooverville conventions behind us. Many of the original personnel are still around, joined by later arrivals. Gregory, our walking encyclopedia of Doctor Who. Lovely Angelina, who has become, despite her initial reluctance, a great convention interviewer. Larry, our AV man, and his wife Eleanor, a friend and former teaching colleague of mine. John R. Walker, our very own Doctor Who star, who has worked as an extra on many TV shows. Bob, whose views on Doctor Who was worth hearing, and the list goes on. Then there are our friends from the neighbouring groups, the Nottingham TARDIS Social Group, the Leicester Doctor Who Group, and the Leeds Hooters. It's always such a pleasure to see them come along to our events. So there we are, Hoovers all. After all these many years, the members of this disparate group of individuals are still among my very best friends. I suppose it's a bit of a cliche to say that we have been brought together by the love of a silly TV show, but have found that we have much more in common. In fact, the truth is both simpler and more complicated. Some of us do indeed share much more than a love of Doctor Who, others of us less so, but that just doesn't matter. The fact that we have that shared interest and we just enjoy each other's company is enough. Long may that continue. And that article was from a forthcoming volume from Watching Books, You and Who's Company. And I'm Stephen Hatcher.
You've been listening to You and Who Talking, presented by Rob Irwin with J.R. Southall. The You and Who books, from which all royalties are paid to charity, are available in print and for Kindle from watchingbooks.weebly.com.